Yes, thank you very much for this brilliant presentation, the ones that we are used to seeing from you. I'll let you catch your breath and say a little about the rest of the evening, because this is your evening. We thought that it was the best idea to, of course, have this presentation, because we need to see what this is all about, but then open the floor immediately. So it's not going to be like, I'm going to interview Professor Lessig. It's you who can now ask questions. But it's very important, I think. We have time, you know, it's 10 to 8, so we have more than an hour for question and answer now. But it's very important to me that you ask your questions as briefly as possible. You're probably all familiar with the situation that everyone feels invited to give a statement of 5 minutes and then ask a fake question to justify the statement. Of course, you know, I'm not going to tell you that you cannot give a statement, but please do it as briefly as possible so we can have as many questions as possible for this long and short time that we have now before us, and also be as precise as possible. For those of you who do not feel comfortable with asking questions in English, ask them in German. I'll just try as best I can to translate them, and if I make any mistakes and you have to protest, just let me know and I'll give it another shot, okay? First of all, you know, you can now, of course, start figuring out what you'd like to ask. I still take the liberty to ask the first question, because I read Lawrence Lessig's new book, which is, you know, here. Oh. Well, it's here. It's called Remix, Making Art and Commerce Thrive in the Hybrid Economy. But it is, in fact, here, because it is downloadable from the internet, of course, where else, under a Creative Commons license. I still bought the book, because right now I still like to read books in print form. This, hopefully, in my opinion, is going to change soon, in the sense that we'll have some gadgets, some technology that makes reading not in a book but on an electronic device as comfortable as we have that now only with printed paper. But that gives you an idea of the hybrid economy that he is talking about in this book, because there are very many different business models that can be used in this hybrid economy, and I think we get the chance to talk about those. But the first question I'd like to ask is, you gave this example of searching for moose and you talked about creativity. And from my experience, I've been dealing with this issue of copyright and creativity for quite some time now. As a journalist, and I'm not an activist, but still as a journalist, you try to convince others of the fact that what you've written is true, not in a philosophical sense of the word, of course, but that you are giving a correct representation of the facts. And every once in a while, I meet artists. You know, I consider myself to be creative, of course, myself. I'm a journalist, but this is different from someone who's a musician, someone who's a video artist, someone who paints pictures. And then many of these artists say that, you know, this is all well with that creativity and the internet and so on and so forth, but I would like to control my work. So, we talked about this before we started. We sort of have a thunderstorm right now in Germany. It's probably a little much to say it's a thunderstorm, but it does make some inroads of a manifesto of creatives, writers, most of them, who are protesting the copyright regime in the sense that it's too lax, which is basically exactly the opposite of what you are talking about. But it seems, in my opinion, that there are many creatives who need to be convinced first before you can start, or someone else can start, convincing lawmakers. Because if every time a lawmaker would say, we would like to change something in the copyright system, and you have this scream of opposition from creatives, policymakers are also in a very bad position. What do you say about that?
Well, one of the worst things that the extremists, the IP, pro-IP extremists in the United States did during the Clinton administration was to create almost a presumption that there was one regime of copyright that should be governing all forms of creativity. So the model of Britney Spears in creating and selling her work was the same way everybody should be thinking about creativity and regulated by copyright. So literally in schools, you had the Motion Picture Association and others participating in educating children about how when they draw a little painting, they should put a little C at the bottom of it and not share their work except subject to copyright control, right? Now, that was a mistake. The models of creativity are different for musicians and filmmakers and novelists and authors and scientists and teachers and universities and all these different organizations. They're different. And it would be a mistake for the free culture movement to make the same mistake that the IP extremists did, to suggest that there's one model everybody ought to be adopting and that's the free model. I don't believe that. So, I would never tell an artist, a novelist, a musician, that they have an obligation, a moral obligation, to make their work freely available. I don't believe that. What we've done with Creative Commons is we've created some tools to enable people to mark their creativity with the freedom they think it should carry. And we've made it available for lots of great artists to use, and artists from David Byrne to Girl Talk have used our licenses to mark their work with the freedoms they wanted to carry. And that's wonderful because it's their choice, and I want them to exercise that choice. I would say, though, to a scientist or a scholar, that your job is to produce not just knowledge, but universal access to knowledge. So if you're a scientist producing information about how to deal with malaria, and you publish that information in a journal that charges $20,000 for people to get a subscription to that journal, meaning the only people who can read your article are rich United States universities and some universities in rich countries like Europe, then you are failing in a moral obligation you have as a scientist, because you've made your work available in a way that it can't be universally accessible. Indeed, it can't be accessible in exactly the places where it's needed, places which have malaria. So I think in the context of science, I do believe there's a moral normative obligation to make work there accessible universally. But I wouldn't say that follows over to the poets or the novelist or the author of books or maybe film. I mean, these are questions for communities of creators to decide. What is the appropriate balance? So I understand, you know, you've told me a little bit, and I've heard some other about the manifesto that's out there and some of the frustration that's driving it. And to the extent that it's a novelist or an author who says that they want to control how their work is accessible, I have no problem with that. I think they should have that freedom. But what I think we need to really understand about where we're going to be in 20 years is that we are going to risk losing an extraordinarily important part of our culture, which is the idea of a library. Right? So I said something about Google Book Search here. I'm actually very skeptical about the Google Book Search project. Not because it's making work available, I think that's fantastic, but because it's making work available in a particular model. The settlement that they've just entered into basically says that for that 75% of works, they can make 20% available for free. And if you want to get access to more than the 20%, you have to pay to get access to the 20%. Now, you know, some of the best times in my life were spent in the Stasi here, right? And the fantastic idea of going to a place where you sat down and you ordered books, which you then put on a pile, and you sat there and spent the whole day, except for the time you're in that really crappy coffee shop, spent the whole day reading these books for free. That was an essential part of what it was to have access to your culture, that you could explore for free, not 20% of the book, but the whole book, right? That's what culture demands to have that kind of access. And the fear I have about the Google Book Search Project is the Google Book Search Project is not building a digital library, it's building a digital bookstore. And then in 20 years, when physical libraries can no longer afford to exist because we're spending all our money dealing with the consequences of global warming, whatever other crisis there is to deal with, then we will have moved into a culture where we don't even have access to our culture. The past is not present because literally you can only get it if you pay for it, and who can afford to pay for that? Now, the thing to recognize is bookstores, publishers, current publishers of novels like that. Because if all you can get access to is the stuff that you're going to buy all the new stuff. And from my perspective, it is an enormously weakened culture that doesn't even have the right to get access to its past. And so as I look at manifestos like this, fighting against, you know, the evolution of digital technology, I fear that in their understandable emotional reaction to what's happening on the internet, they're going to unwittingly play into the hands of commercial interests whose interest is not to guarantee we have access to our cultural past. It's to guarantee that they can continue to grow at 8 or 10% a year and satisfy their stockholders that they're profitable businesses. So I think that ecology is the thing we have to worry about, and I don't yet think that we have a good sense of it.